The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Yosef Schusterman now presents his lecture, From Sinai to Cyberspace.
People say, you know, how does all these new technological things, the medical things, how does halacha seem to talk about it? What do they know about electricity 3,500 years ago? What did they know about transplants 3,500 years ago? What did they know about anything 3,500 years ago? And yet, rabbis are saying, you know, whether you're allowed to do it, you're not allowed to do it. And, like, what's the, where does it all come from? So let's start from the beginning. First of all, the basic premise in Judaism is that God gave us the Torah. It's God's Torah. And if it's God's Torah, God is above time and place. And therefore, Torah applies to all times and places. You can't say Torah was 3,500 years ago, it doesn't apply today, because that means God didn't give it. If God gave it, it's truth. Torah could therefore cannot be changed. It has to be applied. Now, how did it work, this aspect of Torah coming down from heaven? How did it evolve to what we have today, the various different halachic issues that we're going to get into? And how does it work that, you know, where do we see Torah talks about these types of things? So first of all, I wanted to start off by saying a few interesting Talmudic sayings that seem to be very difficult to understand. Number one, the Talmud says like this: any new idea in Torah that a competent Torah student will say was already given to Moses at Sinai. So it seems to be a contradiction within itself. You're saying the Talmud, the student, comes up with a new idea, and you're going to say it was already given. If it was already given, it's not new. If it's new, it wasn't given. So how do you reconcile these two statements within the same phrase? Secondly, if God did give us the Torah, how can there be so many different opinions? What did God say? Did God say you're allowed or not allowed? And we know, if you study anything in Jewish law, there's always an argument. You know, if you want to be safe, if somebody asks you what's the law about a certain thing, you're always safe to say there are different opinions. Because that's the truth. There are different opinions. So how is there so many different opinions? I'm going to tell you a story in the Talmud. The Talmud tells the following story. Two rabbis of the Talmud had an argument in Jewish law. And one of them happened to bump into the prophet Elijah in the street. And he says to him, you know, there's a yeshiva upstairs. God has a yeshiva in Gan Eden, in paradise. There's a yeshiva up there. He says, what is God learning in the, you know, what is he learning? So Elijah answered him, he's learning this and this law, which happened to be the exact law they were arguing about. So he says, great. What does God say? He says, God says, Rabbi so-and-so says this, and Rabbi so-and-so says that. Typical Jew. God's Jewish, by the way. You got to understand that. His sense of humor is Jewish. Anyway, so then the rabbi said to him, does God have doubts? How can you say Rabbi, God, and God himself saying, Rabbi so-and-so says yes, and Rabbi so-and-so says no. And he answered a very general statement. Elu v'elu divrei Elokim chayim. Both are the words of the living God. They're both right. Now let's do another difficult thing to understand. So far we have, if it's new, how is it given? And if it's given, how is it new? And what does it mean, God have doubts? I'm going to tell you another interesting story in the Talmud. Moses, when God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, so afterwards Moses went up to Mount Sinai for 40 days. And the Talmud tells the following story. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, comes up to heaven and he sees God writing crowns on the letters. You know, if you ever look at a Torah scroll, there's not only the letters, there's the little crowns on the letters. So Moses says to God, what is the purpose of those crowns? You're so busy writing the crown. What's the purpose of the crowns? So God said to him, later on in Jewish history, there's going to be a guy by the name of Rabbi Akiva, and he's going to learn mountains of laws from each of the crowns. So Moses was intrigued by that, and he says to God, can I see this guy? Can I meet him? God says, sure. Guys, go through the time machine. He takes Moses to Rabbi Akiva's class, and Moses is sitting in the eighth row, the Talmud says, the last row of Rabbi Akiva's class. And he hears the way Rabbi Akiva is teaching Torah to his students. And Rabbi Akiva is saying things that Moshe didn't even know. And the Gemara says his face dropped, like, I got the book, and this guy is saying things that I don't know about. So all of a sudden, Moshe felt bad. All of a sudden, the student says to Moshe, the student says to Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi, how do you know this law? He says, it was given to Moses at Sinai. And the Talmud says Moses felt better. Now, these three stories are pretty weird. I mean, they're strange. But this shows exactly what the evolution of Torah is all about. If somebody asks a question, is this room big or small? Is it large or small? And somebody will say, it's large. Another person will say, it's small. That doesn't mean they're arguing. It depends compared to what? Compared to the whole hotel, this room is small. Compared to this stender, what they call it, the room is large. Now, it's not a contradiction between the two. It depends how you're analyzing the situation. To give you a biblical example of this, before God brought the flood into the world, God says at the end of the Parsha Bereishis, the first Parsha of the Chumash, Hashem says, people are born bad, and therefore I'm going to destroy the world. Basically, God says, they're born bad anyway, they're bad. What do we need them for? He brought the flood. After the flood, the Torah says, Noah brought sacrifices. When he brought sacrifices, it says God smelled the smell of the sacrifice. And God said, listen, I will not destroy the world anymore because people are born bad. There's one logic over here. A person is born bad. You could analyze it in two ways. Before the flood, God said, people are born bad, let's destroy them. After the flood, God said, if they're born bad, it's not their fault. What do we want from them? Both are right. It depends which perspective, how you're looking at it. So in other words, there are rabbis in Torah, there's a general concept that God gave at Mount Sinai. The rules and generalizations of Torah were given to Moshe at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai. God, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses couldn't have learned the entire Torah with a great teacher and a great student in 40 days to learn an infinite amount of wisdom is mathematically impossible. God gave Moses generalizations, general rules. As Torah evolved throughout all the generations, and it was transmitted orally from Moshe to Joshua to the elders and all the way down through history, until it came the time of the famous sage Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Yehuda the Prince, who was the leader of the Jewish people, extremely wealthy, extremely brilliant in Torah, and he saw that because it was after the destruction of the Second Temple, the Jews were under Roman law. So even though technically, in biblical law, it's forbidden to write the oral law, and it's forbidden to orally say the written law. The Talmud learns out from sentences in scriptures that the written law, the written Torah has to be written, and the oral law has to be oral. You can't write the oral law, and you can't orally say the written law. Now, there's exceptions to the case. Privately, a person was allowed to write down what they learned from their teachers, but to officially organize the entire Talmud or Mishnah, was something which was forbidden. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi came, and he said, based on a sentence in Tehillim, Psalms, King David says, Eis lasis l'Hashem. It comes a time for God. Sometimes, as the Rambam, Maimonides uses the example of this, sometimes you need to amputate a hand to save the life of a person. Sometimes if we don't write the oral Torah down, it's not going to be. We're not going to have any Torah. People are going to forget it. So Rabbi Yehuda Anasi gathered all the scholars of his times, which are hundreds and thousands of scholars. He gathered them at his expense, and everybody worked out all the teachings they had orally, and they worked it out, and they discussed it and debated it, and finally he codified it into something called Mishnah. That's where we get the Mishnah from. That was the doing of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. And he brought down many times arguments in the Mishnah. This rabbi says this, and this rabbi says this. And then, after the era of the Mishnah, generations went downward in the ability to understand. So then we had the Talmud. The Talmud would debate the Mishnah. What does the Mishnah mean? What does it mean in this case? And apply it to this case. And so that's how we got the Talmud. And then you had the Rishonim, like Maimonides and Rashi and those people. And they kept going, evolved down until today. At Mount Sinai, God gave general guidelines for Torah. And God at the same time gave, and we say this every morning in our prayers, right before the official beginning of prayer, the Torah could be derived and explained and expounded upon through 13 different methods, which means as follows. If somebody takes aspects in Torah and expounds upon them based on the guidelines that the Torah tells us you can use, and you're a competent person, meaning you believe completely the Torah comes from God, and you're not changing Torah because God's Torah can't be changed. It came from God. It's automatically truth and authentic. But if you derive laws from Torah in a way that you can apply the law, the general guidelines that Moses was given at Mount Sinai, then you can apply those laws into details. And that's why the Talmud says, if this student comes up with a new concept, it's new because Moses didn't have that detail. Moses was taught the general rule. Now the Talmud, the student, comes up with something novel, a new idea. But the reality is this is only a detail in the general rule that Moses gave. So in essence, it was given to Moses at Sinai. But Moses was given the general rules. The uniqueness and novel aspect of this student was that he applied it to a detail of the law. And the same thing in the story of Rabbi Akiva with Moshe. When Moshe heard something Rabbi Akiva said that he didn't know, he didn't know it because God, he only knew the general rule of it. Moshe Rabbeinu did not need to apply it to that particular detail that was questioned in Rabbi Akiva's lecture. Rabbi Akiva made the law, the generalization of Moses, he brought it down into a practical thing. And therefore, when the student said to him, how do you know this? He said, this came from Moses at Sinai. Because the law is based on the teachings of Moses. So now let's go, I want to get into more practical stuff to see how Torah applies in 2023 and before and after, and by just giving a number of examples where you see where Torah, based on the teachings of Torah, we can solve a lot of, whether it's technology, whether it's medicine, whether it's scientific, no matter what it is, Torah will guide us of how to do it. And in order for this into rule for a rabbi, to be a competent rabbi, to rule halachic rulings, according to Torah, whether it's allowed or not. Number one, I'm going to give certain criteria that the rabbi needs to be able to even try with their best to answer halachic questions. Number one, they have to believe really, that Torah comes from God. It's God's Torah. It's authentic. There's no changing of it. Once you change truth, it's false. Truth is truth, and truth has to say truth. Secondly, the person has to know what the law is. And not only does he need to know the law, as we'll soon discuss, he knows he needs to know the physical question. You know, you could learn about, when a shochet slaughters the animal, he has to take apart the stomach and see if there's any holes or any things or any, growths or whatever. So a guy once brought the stomach of an animal to the rabbi. The rabbi didn't know what the stomach was, but he said, if it's a stomach, it's good. You know what I mean? If it's a stomach, then it's okay. But you have to know what the stomach is. You can't rule, halachic ruling, and I'll show you soon in the practical examples where this actually applied many times. You need to know how to apply the law to the particular case. You need to know, also it's very important, who's asking the question? Rabbis don't always answer the question. They answer the person asking the question. There's a difference if a very, very religious person is asking a question. Is it okay for them to do something? The answer will be no. Because they have to be stricter. And if they have to be stricter, in a stricter way, the answer is no. If it's a person just beginning the journey to Yiddishkeit, to Judaism, then the rabbi will say 100%. You know, do it. It's great. You know. It might be not the highest standards, but for the person, it happens to be very great. Sometimes there's, initially, you're not allowed to, like for instance, you can't mix meat and milk, okay? So you can't pour milk into meat or meat into milk. But what happens if it did mix in by mistake? So then there are laws. If it's 60, it's nullified. If it's less than 60, it's not nullified. But that doesn't mean you could pour in less than 60 times the amount of milk into chicken soup because it's going to be kosher. This is before the fact, after the fact. And then there's another, the Code of Jewish Law, interestingly, has four sections. Called Orach Chaim, Yoredeya, Evan Ezer, Choshen Mishpat. Orach Chaim deals with the daily laws, you know, waking up in the morning, prayer, blessings, Shabbos, holidays, things like that. Yoredeya deals with not a lot of kitchen laws, the laws of mourning, the laws, you know, Avelut, if somebody got forbid loses a parent, the laws of interest, all those types of things. And the last, then Evan Ezer deals with the laws of marriage and divorce. And then the last section, which is called Choshen Mishpat, deals with financial issues, monetary issues. So everybody knows that they say that a rabbi needs the fifth section of Shulchan Aruch. They need the fifth section. That's called common sense, which is very uncommon. So in order to be able to decide these things, I'm giving you examples that will show exactly what I'm talking about, why we need to understand, you need to know what the facts are and you need to know the halacha. For instance, now everybody's into Zoom, okay? During COVID, a lot of synagogues went to Zoom, right? They're still Zooming. Telephones. Microphones, okay? So let's say somebody wants to read, on Purim, we read the Megillah. They want to listen to the Megillah through a Zoom class, through a Zoom, or through the telephone, or for that matter, through a microphone. You know, it's a big place, you want to, or Havdalah, by the way, this will come up Saturday night. Havdalah, can I listen to Havdalah Saturday night? You know, what we do over the cup of wine with the psalmim and everything. Am I allowed to listen to through the telephone? There were very, very great sages, very learned sages that said you're allowed to. Why did they say you're allowed to? They knew the law very well, but they didn't know the scientific fact. They were misled. Somebody told them that if I speak in the telephone and you hear it on the other end, it's the same voice. It's the same voice. They lived in Europe in the shtetl 200 years ago, okay? So when they were asked the question, whenever telephones came out, it was a new thing, and they asked, can we listen to the things through the telephone? And they said, yes, because somebody told them, you speak here and it comes out there, it's the same voice. That doesn't take away from the fact that they weren't big scholars. They were very, very lofty, righteous tzaddikim, righteous people, very learned. But they didn't know the scientific fact. They didn't know that a telephone, a microphone, or a Zoom is a mechanically reproduced voice. Okay? Because if you speak through a microphone, the voice that comes out from the speakers is not my original voice. As everybody knows, if you know technology, it becomes processed and it sounds like my voice, but it's really not. Now, where does Torah talk about that? So basically, according to Halacha, you cannot have a minyan through Zoom. You cannot have listen to the Megillah through Zoom or listen to a Torah reading or do mitzvahs through Zoom. Now, where do we find that in Torah? It doesn't talk about Zoom, it doesn't talk about telephone, it doesn't talk microphones. But there is a din, a law, in the laws of shofar blowing. There's a law that if somebody blows shofar on Rosh Hashanah in a pit, now a pit has an echo many times. So the Talmud says a law that if somebody blows shofar in a pit, don't forget, in the times of the Holocaust, I had teachers that told me they used to listen to shofar in a pit with blankets over their heads. You know what I mean? Just the Nazis shouldn't hear them. So it says in the Talmud like this, in the code of Jewish law, if somebody blows shofar in a pit, if you hear the original voice of the shofar, it's good. If you hear an echo, it's not good. So what is the Talmud basically saying? It doesn't have to say telephone, Zoom, microphone. Talmud says a very clear statement. In order to fulfill a mitzvah, you have to hear the original voice. If you're not going to hear the original voice, then you're not fulfilling your obligation. So if you know what Zoom is and microphones and telephones, so obviously Torah tells us at Mount Sinai, Moses already told us indirectly that you can't listen to, you cannot fulfill your obligations, that you need to hear from the horse's mouth, like they say, you can't fulfill your obligation if you're listening to it through a mechanical reproduced voice. Okay, another example, which is a very interesting, controversial issue today. I'm not going to go into the details because each one of these is a million different details. The question about abortions and heart transplants. Just to give you those examples, because it's very relevant. Is somebody allowed to do an abortion? Is somebody allowed to do a heart transplant? Okay? So now, obviously, they didn't have heart transplants in Maimonides' time. He was a great doctor, but they still didn't have heart transplants. Moses definitely didn't have a heart transplant. So the question is, where does the Torah talk about that? Or abortion? You know, it's a fetus. Well, it's not a human being yet. Why can't they kill it? You know, where does Torah discuss these things? So it's a very simple thing. Torah does discuss the definition of life, when life begins and when life ends. Torah talks about that. Torah talks about, for instance, that life begins from conception. Now, if Torah decides and says that life begins from conception, that means the fetus is already a human being. It's alive. Then an abortion, generally speaking, would be forbidden. Now, there are instances when Torah says an abortion is allowed. For instance, if the mother's life is in danger because of the fetus, so then you're allowed to kill the fetus before the fetus kills the mother. Why is that? Because there's a law in the Gemara, in the Talmud, what's called a rodef. Rodef means if I see A running to kill B, A is running to kill B, and the only way I could stop A from killing B is by killing A, I'm allowed to kill A. That's what the Torah says. The Talmud says. So if that's the case, and by the way, that's only if the only way you can save the life, stop, if you shoot him in the leg and he'll stop, you know, then you're not allowed to kill him. You have to shoot him in the leg or block him or whatever. So if the fetus is, which is a living human being, if this fetus is endangering the mother's life, That's A trying to kill B. So then you're allowed to kill A before A kills B. If that's the only way you could save the mother. If there's another way, then you're not allowed to. But generally speaking, by Torah deciding what is Torah ruling, what is the beginning of life, then Torah talks about abortions. Or another issue, when does life end? Okay, this is a debate even amongst contemporary rabbis today. When does life end? Is it brain death or is it respiratory death? Now, respiratory death, generally speaking, comes after brain death. Okay? In order to do, let's say, I'm using just this because it's a clear example. If I want to take do a heart transplant, you can't take a dead heart and transplant it into somebody else. So what do? As soon as the person is brain dead, the heart is still functioning because there's no respiratory death yet, they'll immediately take out the heart, keep it working, and then transplant it into the person, the recipient. Now, if the definition of death, according to Torah, is brain death, then you would be allowed to do it because then you're not killing the person. The person's dead already, according to Jewish law, and therefore you're just taking out an organ from or a limb from a dead person. But if you halachically hold, which by the way, the majority of opinions today, if you halachically you hold that it's not brain death, it's respiratory death, then you can't take a heart while it's still living because then you're killing the donor. You can't kill the donor to save the recipient, even though the donor is going to die in an hour anyway and the recipient's going to live another 100 years, you still can't kill one person to save another. So now, does the Torah talk about heart transplants? Yeah. Does the Torah speak heart transplants? No. But there's general guidelines the Torah gives us. And from those general guidelines that the Torah gives us, we can apply them to Jewish law. Again, when you realize Torah is from God and what God says, not we're not reforming it, we're not changing it, we're keeping it in the authenticity of Torah. So then Torah talks about heart transplants. I'll give you another example. Am I allowed to, you know, when you have your phones or your computer, right? Many people have the prayers to sit around their phone. Okay. Now, when you go up in the phone, scroll up, yeah? Yet you just had the name of God printed, right? Now, you scroll up, that's disappeared. Did you just erase the name of God? Think about it. Or those of you that are my age or a little bit younger, remember tape recorders? Okay. Tape recorders people used to have for bar mitzvah. The teacher would give them a tape with the bar mitzvah, the Torah portion with them. Okay. What happens after the bar mitzvah? You erase the tape, right? Now, am I allowed to erase the tape? Because God's name is on the tape. Okay, now, did they have tape recorders in God's time? I mean, God's time, yeah. In Moses' time, no. In Maimonides' time, no. In the code of Jewish law time, no. But let's take what Torah does give us guidelines in halacha, and then we can apply it to the modern day things. Now, I'll give you an example. Those that remember, Tolava Shalom, called typewriters. They're dead already. But it used to be a time typewriters were the in thing. Now, when you type a letter on a typewriter, that's a written letter. It's actually a written letter. Does it remember? Okay, good. Yeah, it's a written letter. Computer letters and phone letters are not actually written letters. They're a bunch of dots that makes it look like letters. But it's not a written letter. Therefore, if I scroll up on my phone, I'm not erasing God's name. It's similar. You know what alphabet cereal is? Okay. So let's say you take, or Scrabble. Take a Scrabble set. Not the deluxe, because that you're not allowed to play on Shabbat. But let's say the other one that you technically could, but you can't because you normally write down scores. Okay, but let's leave that. Take Scrabble pieces. Take Scrabble pieces and put G-O-D. Next to each other, G-O-D. Now, that's God's name. Can I take away one piece? Why not? I didn't erase the name of God. I just separated letters or dots that had wrote out God's name, but I didn't erase God's name. So therefore, again, did Torah speak about phones for davening and all that? No. But Torah gives guidelines. What is the definition of erasing God's name? And if the Torah says erasing God's name means when it's a written letter, you're not allowed to erase it. I'll give you another example. This applies even to the laws of Shabbos. You know, in the side of the books, if you take a book out of the library, also all of a shalom, you take the books out of the library, there's written letters, right? The Beverly Hills Library or Palm Springs Library. Okay. So there's letters written over here. Now, if I read that book on Shabbos, I open up the book, what did I just do? I erased letters, seemingly. I close the book, I just wrote letters. But in the Code of Jewish Law, it talks about that case and says you're allowed to. Because you didn't write or erase letters. The letters were there. You just brought them closer and took them further away from each other. But you didn't write or erase, so you'd be allowed to do that on Shabbat. And the same thing with phones or computers. You close your computer, they just had a whole thing on your computer with God's name all over the place. It's halachically, it's not called writing. And therefore, you could take your cell phone into the bathroom. Even though halachically, you don't take a prayer book into the bathroom, it's disrespectful. But your cell phone is not the, it's not the written siddur. It may have a siddur in it and things like that. Another big issue today is surrogate motherhood, right? Surrogate mothers, the mother, a woman gives the eggs, you implant them with the husband's seed, you implant them in another woman, and she carries the baby. Okay, it's a very big thing today. For women that are not able to carry their own babies, they take the husband's sperm and they take their eggs and they implant it in the surrogate mother, and she carries the baby. Okay. It's very nice. Now there's a big problem with that. I'm not saying you can't do it. It could be done. There are ways of doing it, but it has to be dealt with. But let's discuss what's the problem here. What's the issue? Sarah gives the egg. Rebecca carries the baby. Okay? Who is the halachic mother of the baby? Who is the mother of the baby?
The person that carries it.
That's one opinion. Like everything else. Different opinion. No, it's serious. I'm serious. In other words, to rephrase the question, what is the halachic definition of a mother? Is it the one who donates the eggs, and the other one is just an incubator for 9 months? Or is the real mother the one that actually carries the baby? Now, does Torah talk about surrogate motherhood? No. There is a Talmud that talks about artificial insemination, but that's not for now. There was a weird case in the Talmud, says, that they learn out the laws of artificial insemination from. But let's say discuss this case of surrogate. Now, what's the difference who the mother is? Who cares? Okay, it's my mother. No, who cares? There's a lot of difference if you think about it. You can't marry your mother's relatives, correct? Now, who's the mother of this baby as far as who they can marry? Well, I'm just saying the case. The question is, who is the mother of the baby? The egg donor or the carrier? What difference does it make? Everybody agrees to give up the baby and this family is going to raise the kid and the same first name, last name, everything. The bottom line is, halachically, who is the legal mother of the baby? Now, what difference does it make? Number one, like I just said, marrying the mother's relative, let's say, hypothetically. Laws of inheritance, a child inherits the mother. Who is the halachic mother of the child? God forbid when the mother passes away, does the child have to sit Shiva? Is it his halachic mother or not? If it's halachic mother, you sit Shiva, God forbid. If it's not your halachic mother, you could, but you don't have to. Or other laws that pertain Like if a person is careful about not being alone with a woman, unless if it's your mother, grandmother, sister, you know, those things. So now the question is, hugging, kissing, touching. If a person doesn't touch relatives, you know, according to Allah, you shouldn't be touching even relatives that are not parents, grandparents, sisters, whatever. All going. But now the question is, who's the halachic mother of that child? So there is a very big controversy today in the world of halacha. Now, again, where do they get the sources from? This all originates from Mount Sinai. What the Torah defines, what is the definition of a mother of a child? Is it the egg donor or is it the carrier? Is it the incubator? Or maybe she was the one that actually gave birth to the child. And this is discussed. And again, for people to make a halachic ruling about these things, they have to be extremely knowledgeable in halacha, in Torah law, and they have to be extremely knowledgeable in the medical aspects of it. Because if not, how are they able to make a ruling if they don't know? So one second. So just to explain to you, and again, I'm not saying you're not allowed to do it, I'm not saying, but it has to be dealt with a competent rabbi that's knowledgeable. So what do they say? Because we don't know who's the mother, because, I have another more important question. The donor egg is Jewish. The carrier is not. This is the real major question. I don't know why I didn't say it earlier. The real question over here is, the donor egg is Jewish. The donor, okay? The surrogate mother who's carrying the baby is not Jewish. Now, if the mother is the donor egg, then the kid would be Jewish. If the surrogate mother, the carrier, is the mother, then the kid's not Jewish. But if you hold the surrogate mother is the mother, the carrier, and the donor is not the mother, then, so you don't know who, you have to know if the kid's Jewish or not. So therefore, what do they rule today? It's a little complicated, but generally, general rule, there's exception to every rule. The general rule is, you go strict both ways. So if either one of them is not Jewish, the donor or the carrier, they try to get them to convert. To know what the, because we don't know. It's income. Many opinions say, more and more they're saying the carrier, but not everybody agrees with that, that the carrier is actually the mother of the child. And then again, that the major issue is the kid Jewish or not? That's a very big question. So that needs to be dealt with. Electricity. Okay, using of electricity on Shabbat. Is it allowed? Now, obviously, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't talk about electricity. Neither did Maimonides or the other codifiers. But the question is, everybody says electricity is forbidden to use on Shabbat. That's a given. The question is why? Why is electricity forbidden on Shabbat? So some opinions in halacha say it's fire. You know, electricity, Benjamin Franklin, what did he discover? Electricity is fire, whatever. Anyway, something like that. So it's fire. So the Torah says clearly, you cannot, you're not allowed to create a fire on Shabbat. So if electricity is fire, so then you're creating a spark, which is electricity, which is forbidden. What happens if you hold electricity as not fire? Or certain electrical things may not have fire in it. So it's interesting. There are other opinions that say interesting reason why electricity is forbidden on Shabbat. And that's because one of the forbidden, prohibited things which are forbidden to be done on Shabbat is bona, construction. You can't construct. And they say very interesting. When you flick a switch, you close the circuit, which makes the things work. You unflick the switch, close it, so then you're stopping the closed circuit. Now, if I close a circuit, I just built a circuit. So it's actually forbidden on Shabbat because I constructed something, and construction is forbidden to do on Shabbat. Some people say it's electricity. Some people say, everybody says it's forbidden. Many people question, is it biblically forbidden, rabbinically forbidden? But it's forbidden. That's a given. Which really, there's no difference nowadays if it's biblical or rabbinic. It's still forbidden.
please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.